word. The banker couldn't tell which of them to focus on, and his eyes swept back and forth between them as he tried to decide whom to address.
I have no idea what you're talking about. What money?
McGee glanced past Stevenson to the credenza filled with family photos. There were pictures from the beach, fishing trips, camping, sailing, even shots from Cub Scouts with Stevenson, apparently a den leader or scoutmaster of some sort in uniform.
There's money missing from the Caring International account, Mr. Stevenson.
I'm sorry, said the banker. Who are you again?
Mr. McGee, Ryan stated, is on loan to the agency from the Attorney General's office.
But I didn't do anything. Why are you here asking me questions?
McGee pulled out a manila file folder, stuffed with printouts he had fished out of the dumpster behind the office supply store. Across the outside of the folder in capital letters, he had written, Confidential Case File, Stevenson, Eric, along with the name of his position and the name of the bank. He held it up so that Stevenson could see the writing, but not the documents he was flipping through inside. CARE International was the name of the NGO front organization that Ryan's political destabilization team had operated under. Knowing the CIA in general, and Phil Durkin in particular, if the program had been moved to the dark side, she doubted they would have built a whole new cover for it. They would have changed passwords and authorizations, but probably not much of anything else. She had come to see Stevenson in order to put that assumption to the test. If the funds were still flowing, that would jump their investigation to an entirely new level.
Eric, listen, said Ryan. If you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about.
Of course I haven't done anything wrong, he insisted. I'm a patriot. I don't steal from you guys. I'm here because I want to help you. I want to help my country.
Although she didn't let it show, that remark was like having a little knife slipped between her ribs and up into her heart. Stevenson was a good man. She didn't like doing this to him, but people's lives were on the line, including her own.
Then the sooner you cooperate with us, the sooner we can get out of here, she replied.
I am cooperating.
Then tell me why funds are missing from the Caring International account.
Because I was told to bring that account down to a certain level.
Ryan looked at him.
Told by whom?
Durkin.
Why would he tell you to do that?
Stevenson put up his hands.
I provide the accounts, and I move the money as directed. That's it. Everything else is on your end. Speaking of which, something's not making sense about all of this.
What's not making sense? She asked.
You,
the banker replied.
Your name was removed from everything.
Durkin called me himself and told me to scrub you from all of it. He said you were moving on to a new position or something, said he wasn't going to be working with you anymore. That's why I was so surprised to see you. If there's a problem with the money, why didn't I get a call from Durkin?
Ryan, who had come up with the ruse of misappropriated funds, had thought the banker might take this road, but McGee was way ahead of her.
Ah, yes. Mr. Durkin, McGee said, cocking an eyebrow as he removed another file, this time with Durkin, Philip, written across the front of it. Mr. Stevenson, how long have you been conducting transactions with Mr. Durkin?
The banker was thrown off balance and was suddenly nervous again.
I don't know. About 6 years?
Are you asking me, Mr. Stevenson? McGee stated. Or are you telling me?
I guess I'm telling you. That is to say, I am telling you.
During those 6 years, did you ever assist Mr. Durkin in setting up a personal offshore account for his own use in Grand Cayman?
No, of course not.
Zurich?
No.
Andorra?
I never did any private personal banking for him.
McGee ran his finger down an imaginary list in his Durkin file. So, no accounts then in Gibraltar, Grenada, Belize, or Vanuatu either?
My God, he's got that many personal accounts?
There's a lot of money missing, Mr. Stevenson.
The banker turned to Ryan and implored her,
Lydia, you have to trust me. Whatever money is missing, I had nothing to do with it. The Caring International account was drawn down and a new account was started.
New account for whom? She asked.
The same team. The only name I left off was yours.
Bingo.
Did it ever occur to you that Durkin might not have been authorized to ask you to do that?
Stevenson gaped at her.
Lydia, you guys came to me. I didn't come to you. I manage a small community bank. One day, a couple of CIA agents walk in. I think they're here for a small business loan, and suddenly, I'm being asked to serve my country, all without leaving my office.
He paused for a moment.
My wife warned me something like this might happen. What have I gotten myself into?
Big trouble, that's what, McGee replied.
Hold on, Ryan said, intervening. If what Eric is telling us is true, then the investigation should focus on Durkin.
It is true. It is,
the banker stated emphatically.
McGee looked skeptical and remained silent.
What name is the new account under? She asked.
Stevenson turned to his computer and brought it up.
They kept the same NGO structure, just changed the name to Hands of Peace International.
When did the account last receive funding?
2 weeks ago.
Credit cards, wire transfers, it's all feeding into that account?
The banker punched a couple more keys.
Through a series of branch accounts, yes.
Ryan looked at McGee. It was now time to give Stevenson a way out.
I think we know now how Durkin has been hiding the money, she said.
That doesn't change Mr. Stevenson's involvement, he replied.
The banker started to protest, but Ryan held up her hand to quiet him. Turning to her partner, she said, Bob, I think Eric has proven he's willing to cooperate with us.
McGee tapped the Durkin file against his thigh as he pretended to mull it over. That might not be good enough.
Not be good enough, Stevenson exclaimed. What else do you want from me?
My biggest problem, Mr. Stevenson, he responded, is your safety.
My safety?
And your family's. The banker's eyes had gone wide again.
Why would we be in any danger?
Suffice it to say that since we began our investigation, banking in some parts of the world has become particularly dangerous, especially if Phil Durkin is your client.
Oh my God, what am I supposed to do? What about my wife and my children? What if Durkin calls me? What do I tell him?
If Durkin calls you, Ryan instructed, just act natural. Handle whatever he asks for, and that's all. Be professional and be polite.
He'll know I know something.
No, he won't. Relax.
And my family? How are you going to protect us?
The only way we can help you, said McGee, is if you help us.
The banker opened his arms.
I'll give you anything you want. What is it?
An hour later, they walked out of the bank with a cardboard banker's box, which contained a paper trail a mile long. Now what? McGee asked, as they climbed into the Mustang and the first drops of rain began to fall on the windshield.
Now that we know who's putting the meat in the cage, Ryan said as she put the key in the ignition and fired up the car, it's time to rattle it.
Off in the distance, there was a low growl of thunder. It was matched by the throaty growl of the Mustang as Ryan pulled away from the curb and pointed the car back toward Fort Belvoir. She had already decided what they would do next. McGee was going to like it even less than he had her idea that they shelter in place at Brenda Durkin's house. But as dangerous as this next step was, they had been left with no other option.
Chapter 34. Boston, Massachusetts.
Patience had never been Harvath's strong suit, but the SEALs had taught him well. He'd gone from a toe-tapping, I-want-it-all-to-happen-now immature kid to a thoughtful, risk-assessing, mission-focused young man who could wait in the tiniest of hide sites or lie prone for days on end until the absolute right moment to hit his target. None of it was easy, and it often sucked, but he'd learned how to put the mission above himself, and that had marked a watershed moment in his life.
Never had he been prouder than when he had finally become a United States Navy SEAL. On his first mission, it was immediately apparent why his SEAL instructors had been so incredibly hard on him and his teammates. When you were dropped far behind enemy lines, and it seemed like one thing after another was going wrong, and one piece of equipment after another was failing, you knew you would still accomplish your mission. Failure was not an option. And as the SEALs were famous for saying, the only easy day was yesterday. At this point, there was nothing Harvath could do but wait. Cordero had submitted the wrist cuff to the crime lab unit to have it fingerprinted and had asked them to get it done ASAP. They understood that Cordero was investigating a possible serial killer and promised they would get it done as quickly as they could. In the meantime, patrol officers and FBI agents were canvassing and re-canvassing all of downtown, including the area around the Liberty Tree Building, Boston Common, and the Granary Burying Ground. Additional officers had been assigned to review all of the CCTV footage that they could get their hands on from the last 48 hours, including footage from the airport and train and bus stations. Marquardt had been killed the same night she was taken, based on her ears being removed, as well as those of Kelly Davis here in Boston. Harvath was certain it was the same person. He had to have gotten from Georgia to Boston somehow. With Brittany's description of the man who had assaulted her, as well as Agnes's description of the man Kelly Davis had last been seen with, Harvath was hoping that they'd stumble across something, either on camera or in the minds of people who might have seen him. To their credit, the Boston PD and the FBI were keeping a lid on the details surrounding Penning's murder, which Harvath was grateful for. Kelly Davis's murder had been reported as a potential homicide of a young woman from South Boston. None of the details, other than her body being found in the Charles, had been released to the press. The monotony of having been inside the homicide unit at police headquarters most of the day was wearing on Harvath. One of the detectives had made a run to Potbelly for lunch, but that had been hours ago. He needed a break. He needed to get outside, take a walk, and get some fresh air. It had started raining, but Harvath didn't care. He traded Cordero his cell number for an umbrella. When his phone rang four blocks later, and the caller ID showed a blocked number, he thought it might be her with a breakthrough on the case. It turned out to be Bill Wise from D.C. "What's all that noise in the background?" he asked.
"It's raining," replied Harvath, "and I'm out on the street. Hold on a second. There's a doorway up ahead. I'm going to duck in there."
When Harvath had reached it, he stepped in and said,
"Okay, this should be better. Go ahead."
"I've done some digging since you were here last night, and I think I may have found something interesting. When can you get over here?"
"I'm not sure. I'm up in Boston right now."
"What are you doing in Boston?" Wise asked.
"Long story. You tell me your news first."
There was the sound of pages flipping, as if Wise was going through a notebook or something. Finally, he said,
"Remember how I told you that when I joined the agency, they were doing lots of interesting programs?"
"Yes, I do remember."
"Well, there were rumors that one of those programs was running parallel to mine. Instead of taking operatives and making them more capable killers, it was taking killers and trying to make them into capable operatives."
Harvath was taken aback for a moment.
"Like psychopaths?"
"Psychopaths, sociopaths, antisocial personalities, you name it. The program's pendulum swept the full spectrum of psychological dysfunction."
"Why?"
"They wanted a stable of operatives who would kill on command, without any hesitation, without any resistance, remorse, or moral hangover. The agency wanted to be able to wield a scalpel that never blunted from use, nor ever questioned why it was being used. In essence, they were trying to create the ultimate assassin."
Harvath was confused.
"Isn't that the kind of crackpot stuff they were toying around with back in the 1960s?
1960s? They've been throwing millions of dollars down rat holes since the 1950s, trying to figure out how to pharmacologically and surgically unplug people from their moral compasses. But it wasn't until the success of the Human Genome Project and huge leaps forward in neuroscience in the 2000s that the agency discovered their path forward.
And with the tidal wave of money that flooded into the intelligence community after 9/11, Harvath stated, I assume they were able to fund almost any bizarre programs they wanted.
That's right, said Wise. A lot of the money that flowed in did so via black accounts with no accountability and no congressional oversight. The only thing requested was that the money be used to make America safer.
You can hang a lot of ornaments on that kind of Christmas tree.
Don't misunderstand. There were some excellent programs the agency pursued. There were also, unfortunately, some less than excellent programs.
Harvath thought about Claire Marquardt and everything that had now happened in Boston.
Did the program you're talking about have a name?
Its code name was Swim Club. Rumor had it that it came from the CIA's desire to see how deep the psychological pool was for these types of candidates. They had begun by trolling state mental facilities, but then realized they needed a much bigger net. They created one of the first electronic medical record software companies, which allowed them to sift through reams of patient information, but even that wasn't enough. They couldn't monopolize the EMR industry, so they simply hacked into medical databases from insurance companies, psychiatry and psychology practices, addiction and recovery centers, even hospital CT scan departments. They hit a thick vein in the criminal justice system. But the real pay dirt came when they conned the military via a phony counseling organization to deal with not only psychologically unbalanced applicants, but also existing service members who snapped or suddenly became psychologically unfit for service.
Whiffle, a military-style crew cut.
Harvath could feel himself gripping the phone tighter.
Are you saying vets who needed counseling were purposely not getting it?
On the contrary, if you made it into the agency's program, you'd be getting exceptional counseling. The problem was that you'd also be getting sized up for membership in Swim Club.
Harvath wasn't sure he had heard the man correctly.
You think the agency is behind the attacks on the Fed?
Why not? The CIA may be overflowing with bureaucrats, but it still has plenty of Americans concerned with the survival of the country.
While there were lots of bureaucrats in the intelligence community who Harvath didn't care for, there were also many exceptional Americans who risked everything day in and day out for their love of the United States. But to kill otherwise innocent people just because they disagreed with what the Federal Reserve was doing? That didn't make sense. But what if Wise was correct? What if it was elements within the CIA that were behind the attacks on the Fed?
You said these were rumors. Can they be substantiated? Is Swim Club legit? Is it a live program?
As of last year, yes, it was a live black program. But then the new CIA director allegedly caught wind of it. He not only didn't like it, he also didn't like its potential for disastrous PR fallout if word ever leaked and had it shut down. Staff were either moved to other projects or dismissed entirely, said Wise.
How did you find all this out?
I made a couple of phone calls and ended up getting plugged back into an old colleague of mine named James Gage. Jim's a PhD who had worked on my project for a while before being transferred. I didn't see him much after that, but guess where it turns out he was transferred to?
Swim Club, said Harvath.
Yep. When they let him go, he was pretty bitter. He probably talks more than he should, but old friends do that, right?
While Harvath was careful about discussing classified operations, Wise had a point. There were more than a few people who talked out of school. He'd seen it in the military and intelligence worlds and had no reason to doubt that scientists or researchers were any different. Old friends, especially those expected to keep similar secrets, did talk.
Jim filled in several blanks for me, Wise continued. The ones he didn't were easy enough to figure out. A couple of times it was nothing more than the look on his face. His silence on some of the information spoke volumes.
"Wait a second. You met with Gage in person?" Harvath asked.
"Of course. Why not?"
"Did anyone see you? Does anyone else know you were with him?"
Wise could tell something was very wrong. "No, no one saw us. No one knows. But something is bothering you. What is it? What's going on up there?"
"Our killer struck again overnight," Harvath replied. "Twice."
Chapter 35 Harvath gave Wise a full rundown of everything that had happened. The man took copious notes on the other end of the phone. When Harvath was done filling him in, Wise was in full clinical mode.
"So, what does all of this tell us?" he asked rhetorically. "Our man is professional, at least when it comes to his work. As far as we know, there were no clues left at the Marquardt murder scene on Jekyll Island, or at the Penning murder at the Liberty Tree building. But in what we'll call his personal life, he's appearing impulsive, less careful. Perhaps he's even losing control."
Harvath let out a long breath.
"What is it?" said Wise. "You disagree?"
"Not necessarily. I'm just trying to process all of this. Listen, I don't like to underestimate anyone, especially someone this dangerous. But I also don't like to overestimate them either."
"You think I'm giving him too much credit?"
"What I think is that the guy screwed up. Whether he is a sociopath or a psychopath or whatever, I'm not a doctor and I don't care. What I know is that as good as he's been, he's finally made a mistake. Is he losing control? Maybe. But when he grabbed that girl's wrist in the granary burying ground, I don't think he could have known that he would go on to kill that night, that he'd kill a friend of the girl he grabbed, or that we'd tie it all together."
Wise agreed. "Well, that makes sense. But keep in mind that not only are we potentially dealing with someone who is not rational and who does not make sense, but he's now killed 3 people. If I'm right, and he is losing control, he may become more dangerous."
"He may also make another mistake," Harvath replied. "Speaking of which, what do you make of how the body of the young girl was left in the Charles River? Does that tell you anything?"
"It tells me several things. The first is that this was likely an impulsive crime of opportunity. The woman made herself available to him, and he struck. Once he did, though, he had a decision to make. Presumably, he could have left her right where he killed her, but instead, he risked the added time to steal the things he needed, weigh her down, and then drop her in the water."
"Which means what?"
Wise took a few moments to reflect before answering. "Whoever this girl was, I think we can safely assume he hadn't come to Boston to kill her."
"But he cut her ears off like he had with Claire Marquardt. Why?"
"Without interviewing him, it's hard to say for sure. He may have simply enjoyed it and wanted to relive it, or he may have rushed Marquardt's murder and wanted to take his time with the prostitute. Remember, for a lot of these killers, the act is all about the power they wield over their victims."
"And weighing the body down in the Charles?" Harvath asked.
"Perhaps he was ashamed of what he had done and wanted, symbolically, to be rid of it. Or maybe he realized on some level that this impulsive act was a mistake that could not only jeopardize him, but also his operation. Therefore, he had worked to cover it up as quickly as possible."
Processing information from Bill Wise was like drinking from a fire hose. Harvath was still trying to wrap his mind around the fact that there could be even a remote CIA component to the attacks. Circumventing alarm systems like the one at the Registry of Motor Vehicles, as well as looping CCTV footage, though, was straight out of the agency's playbook.
"Could the killer have weighted the body down simply because he needed to buy time?" Harvath asked.
"For what?"
"He killed Marquardt in Georgia, then came up here for Penning. Maybe he's traveling by air and didn't want the body to be found until after he had made it safely away to wherever he was going next."
As he waited for the man to respond, Harvath ran the list of remaining kidnap victims through his mind. Betsy Mitchell, Seattle, Jonathan Renner, San Francisco, and Peter Whalen, Chicago. Since getting the call to come to Boston, He had been racking his brain trying to zero in on locations in the remaining kidnapped cities that would be symbolic for the group behind the killings. The only thing he could come up with was that they all had Federal Reserve branches. But would the killer be that obvious, especially after the choices of Jekyll Island and the Liberty Tree site?
"There is another possibility," Wise said, interrupting Harvath's train of thought. "What if you're right? What if the killer was trying to buy more time? Not to get out of Boston, but rather because his work in Boston wasn't complete."
Harvath was about to comment when his other line rang.
"Bill, I have another call. Stand by for a second."
"Will do."
Harvath clicked over to the other line. It was Cordero, back at police headquarters.
"The crime lab just called," she said. "They finished processing the wrist cuff."
"Did we get any prints?"
"We did. It looks like a thumb and a partial that may be an index finger. They're working up the report now. How soon can you get back here?"
"I'm only a couple of blocks away," he said. "I'll be there in less than 5 minutes."
10-4. Hurry up. As soon as we get the prints, we're going to start running them through the databases."
With that, she said goodbye and hung up. Cordero and the FBI could run every database she had access to, but he doubted she was going to get a single hit. If this guy was who Harvath was beginning to think he might be, there was only one place that would have a record of him, and even then it would be guarded like Fort Knox. He clicked back over to Wise.
"We got a hit on the wrist cuff from the girl accosted at the Granary Burying Ground. We believe it's a thumb and a partial index finger."
"That's terrific."
"Do you think your swim club pal Gage can do anything with it?" asked Harvath.
He could sense Wise's hesitation before he even responded.
"At the CIA, when you're gone, you're gone. They watch you clean out your desk, and then they go through everything, and I mean everything, before you're escorted off the property. All of your access is canceled, and the only information you're leaving with is what's between your ears. He's not going to be sitting on reams of data, much less the jackets of the people Swim Club was spinning up to place in the field. There were a bunch of them, and most were freelancers with lives entirely separate from the agency. They just got called up when Langley needed them."
"Wait," said Harvath. "You're telling me they can lead normal lives? How the hell is that even possible?"
"Think of them like alcoholics. Some were exceptional at hiding their illness. With treatment, they were quite functional."
"And the others?"
"With time, the others lost the fight and fell over the edge."
It was a chilling analogy. Harvath wanted as much information as he could get.
"Reach out to Gage," he said, "and lean on him as hard as you can for whatever he can give you."
"How much are you comfortable with me revealing to him?"
"Right now? Limit it just to the killer," Harvath replied. "You can use the partial description we have, and feel free to talk about his M.O. as much as you want, but keep the names of the victim and any mention of the Fed out of it."
"Understood," said Wise. "Email me the prints, and I'll let you know if I find out anything."
"Sounds good. There's just one last thing."
"What's that?"
"Be very careful who else you talk with beyond this Gage fellow, and make sure to keep a pair of eyes in the back of your head."
"Same goes for you," Wise said. "Our killer isn't done yet, not by a long shot. He not only likes to kill, he's compelled to. And if he did come out of Swim Club, he's very, very good at it."
"So am I," said Harvath,
ending the call and slipping the phone back into his pocket. Stepping out into the rain, he opened his umbrella and headed back toward One Schroeder Plaza and Cordero's office. As he walked, he was haunted by several of the things Bill Wise had said, not the least of which was that their killer might still have work left to do in Boston. Chapter 36. Detective Cordero was on the phone, trying to make childcare arrangements when Harvath hung up his coat and set the umbrella she had lent him in the corner.
"Okay, I understand. Thank you," she said, and then hung up.
Looking at Harvath, she stated,
"I'm definitely in the wrong business."
"Why?"
"The daycare center where I have my son charges $1 a minute for every minute after 5 that you're not there to pick him up."
"That's pretty steep."
"It is, but I understand.
Too many parents are irresponsible these days. If they didn't have some sort of penalty, people would be leaving their kids there until midnight. What about you?
What about me?
Asked Harbeth. Are you married? Do you have any kids? He smiled.
No.
Divorced?
No.
I knew it, she said. The haircut and suit were a dead giveaway.
A dead giveaway to what?
Don't be so defensive. Boston's a very progressive city. We've got a few gay cops on the force here.
Harvath laughed. I'm not gay. And by the way, this is a Brooks Brothers suit, and I've had the same haircut since college.
Cordero looked at him for several seconds.
What are you looking at? Said Harvath.
You've got to be, what, in your mid, maybe late 30s? That was a heck of a compliment, and one he had no intention of correcting her on.
Give or take, he replied.
So what's your problem? Never grew up? Peter Pan syndrome?
Boy, is she direct.
Just never met the right girl. Your first mistake, said Cordero, was looking for a girl instead of a woman.
Brutal, too.
And my second mistake? Allowing yourself to get to this age without realizing you're the problem?
Wow. This is turning into a heck of a beating. I hope your paramedics respond faster than your crime lab.
Cordero smiled. What? No defense of your lifestyle? Isn't right about now the time you're supposed to stand up for confirmed bachelorhood? You know, trot out that old, don't hate the player, hate the game line.
My bad, Harvath replied. I didn't know there was a protocol for this sort of guy bashing. Speaking of which, why isn't Mr. Cordero helping you figure out picking up your son?
The smile faded from her.
Because he's deceased. He died shortly before Marco was born.
Harvath felt like a total asshole and winced at her response.
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
It's not your fault, she replied, attempting to bring back a small smile in order to take the sting out of the exchange.
How could you?
Was he a cop?
No, stockbroker. We'd known each other since grade school.
So Cordero is your married name?
It's my maiden name. He had this long Eastern European name with a billion consonants that nobody could ever pronounce. I decided to keep my name.
Marriage is all about give and take.
That's what they say, right? Said Harvath. Cordero rolled her eyes.
I know nothing about you, yet I get this sense, and I hope I don't hurt your feelings, but you're a real idiot. You either have yourself convinced that it's easier to just drift from one casual thing to the next in a state of perpetual adolescence, or you're looking for that perfect 10. That sort of thing doesn't exist. If you're hitting on 5 out of 6 cylinders, or even 4 out of 6 with someone who truly cares about you, you should run, don't walk, all the way to the bank with it.
If it's that easy, how come you're not remarried?
I never said it was easy, she corrected him. It's hard work. But along with raising a child, it's the most rewarding hard work you'll ever do. Even better than being a SEAL. If only you knew how to swim.
And if I was?
Cordero rolled her eyes again.
And if you were smart enough. I got that part the first time, too.
Any chance we can talk about something other than my love life?
The detective slid the crime lab report across her desk. Harvath skimmed it and eventually said,
So, based on the elimination prints they used from Brittany Doyle's arrest record, the crime lab is certain this other full and partial print belongs to our killer?
No, that's not what they do. That's our job. All they can tell us is, the two prints we have been given do not belong to Ms. Brittany Doyle of Southie. The additional prints belong to someone else.
So, what's the next step? He asked,
knowing already what her answer was.
We begin searching the databases. We already sent a copy of the prints to the FBI, so we'll start with state and local. If we don't come up with anything, we'll go international. Sound like a plan?
I think I'd rather go back to getting lectured about my love life.
Don't worry. I can walk and chew gum at the same time. We'll do both.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Harvath replied.
Listen, as much as I enjoy discussing my shortcomings with people I've just met, why don't we bifurcate our work? You take the state and local databases, and if you give me a computer, I'll work on the international. That way we'll be twice as fast, and hopefully get you to your little boy by 5 o'clock. Make sense?
Cordero smiled.
Whatever his problem was, a healthy sense of humor and what appeared to be a decent sense of compassion weren't part of it. Once again, she found herself attracted to him. More unsettling, though, was her growing feeling that whatever was wrong with him relationship-wise, she could fix it. But then, there was her rational side. Through years of counseling broken-hearted girlfriends over countless glasses of wine, she knew what a dangerous proposition that was. You couldn't fix something that was intent upon staying broken. After showing Harvath to an available computer, she pushed her romantic notions from her mind and returned to her desk so she could begin scouring the databases. In any other circumstance, Harvath would have smiled and watched a woman like Lara Cordero as she walked away. Not now, though. Now, all he was focused on was catching a killer, and catching him before he could kill again. Chapter 37. Harvath went through the motions of searching all the databases he had access to, but he knew he wasn't going to find anything. Even if their killer had a prior record, it would have been scrubbed clean. An operation this sophisticated, regardless of who was behind it, would not roll the dice on everything falling apart because their lead hitter had his prints on file in a law enforcement database somewhere. That didn't mean, though, that his prints didn't exist somewhere. If the man was indeed part of some black ops program, the agency was going to have a full dossier on him. Accessing that dossier, though, was going to be very difficult, particularly if the powers that be at Langley were trying to keep the program secret. Based on what he had heard about Swim Club, if the guy they were looking for was a part of it, Harvath would have a better chance locating Jimmy Hoffa than the man's personal information. He decided to turn it over to the old man. Monroe Lewis wanted regular updates, and he owed Reed Carlton a situation report anyway. Typing up a brief synopsis, Harvath transmitted it to Carlton via a secure server they used. Attached to the email were photos from the crime scenes, as well as scans of the prints the Boston PD crime lab had isolated from Brittany Doyle's wrist cuff. He asked him to please forward the materials along to Bill Wise. With the two of them working on the prints, there was nothing else he could do in that arena, and he logged off the computer. Pushing his chair out from the desk, he stood and walked back to Cordero.
"Any luck?" he asked.
"Nothing. You?"
Harvath shook his head.
"You knew we weren't going to find anything, didn't you?"
"I had a pretty good feeling," he replied. "Whoever this guy is, he's a pro."
"A professional psychopath?" Cordero replied.
Looking at her watch, she said,
"I've got to pick up my son. Are you staying in Boston tonight?"
Harvath hadn't thought that far ahead.
"I'm not sure. It depends."
"On whether or not the killer is still here?"
He nodded.
"Five victims from five different cities," she said. "For all we know, the killer has already left Boston and is on his way to the next."
"That's the problem. He could be anywhere. I've got no idea."
"Any reason at all to think he may still be here?" she asked.
Harvath thought back to what Wise had said.
"There may be a slim chance, a very slim chance."
"Based on what?"
"I spoke with an expert back in D.C. Call him a profiler. He thinks one of the reasons the killer weighted Kelly Davis down and sunk her in the river, rather than leave her body wherever he killed her, was that he needed to buy himself more time."
"You don't seem convinced," said Cordero.
"My question is, what would he be buying more time for? To get out of town and get to one of those other cities? Or is it something else?"
"What does your profiler think?"
"He thinks maybe the killer still has unfinished business here."
"You're the guy who paid attention in history class," she stated. "If this guy was going to stage another murder in Boston, where would he do it?"
Harvath had already thought about that, and had been doing a little research online. It could be any number of locations, but there was no reason, apart from Wise's speculation, to believe that the killer hadn't already left. Cordero glanced at her watch once more.
"Go pick up your son," said Harvath.
"What about you?"
"I'll be fine. I'll probably hang around here a little bit longer to see if anything breaks. Maybe the FBI will get lucky. If not, I'll head back to D.C.
"And what if the killer is still here?" she asked.
"Then I guess you and I'll see each other again."
Cordero and Harvath shook hands, holding on a fraction of a second longer than they should have.
"Stay safe, Annie Oakley,"
he said, as she let go of his hand and brushed past him to pick up her umbrella and a small plastic bag with a box in it.
"You too," the detective replied.
As she reached the door, the answer to the question she had asked him popped into his mind, and he said,
"Fort Hill."
Cordero stopped and turned around.
"What?" "You asked me where I thought the killer would stage another Boston murder if he was still here, and the answer is Fort Hill."
"The water tower in Roxbury?" she replied, as her partner entered the office and walked past her.
"Water tank," the male detective corrected her,
drawing out the words in his heavy Boston accent as he sat down at his desk.
"Excuse me, water tank."
"No," said Harbath. "We're talking about two different things. It's a fort."
"It was a fort," Cordero's partner said. "When the town of Roxbury was annexed by Boston in the 1800s, they put a water tank on Fort Hill, made to look like some fairy princess tower, and renamed the area Highland Park."
Cordero looked at her partner.
"Where the hell did that come from?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Other than arcane Red Sox trivia, I've never heard you mention one historical thing about Boston."
"I guess you just don't know me."
She stared at him, half in disbelief, and half with a conviction that he was not telling her the full truth. The male detective looked at Harbath and said,
"Do you want to tell her why Fort Hill is significant, or should I?"
Though Harbath didn't know the man from Adam, he was equally stunned by his sudden fluency in Boston history, and chose to let him keep the floor.
"By all means," Harbath said.
"Please."
The male detective looked at his partner and said,
"After Penning's murder this morning, I decided to do a little research."
Cordero was going to be late picking up her son, but this was more than worth a dollar a minute.
"Do tell, Sal."
"I'm a smart guy, with an even smarter smartphone," he said with a smirk. "So I researched what happened after they hung Andrew Oliver's effigy from the Liberty Tree."
"And?"
"The mob ginned itself up and ended up tearing down that dockside warehouse Oliver owned, probably because that's where he was storing all the stamps from King George."
"What does that have to do with Fort Hill?"
"Oliver lived at the foot of Fort Hill. The mob set the effigy up in front of his house, chopped its head off, and set it on fire. When local law enforcement showed up and tried to calm things down, they got showered with rocks. The crowd then looted Oliver's house and set it on fire. The next day, Oliver resigned his commission from King George, but the colonists weren't done with him. They made him march down and publicly renounce his office beneath the Liberty Tree."
Cordero's partner shifted his gaze to Harbath and said,
"Correct?"
Harbath hated to hand it to the guy, but he had done his homework.
"That's right," he replied.
"So let's pass that along to the FBI and beef up patrols around Highland Park and the water tank just in case. We'll see what happens."
"Sounds like a plan," said Cordero, who then looked at Harbath and asked, "How about dinner? What about your son?"
"My parents live in the apartment above mine. They're older, they don't drive anymore, but they can babysit after I get Marco put to bed. If the killer is still here, you want a crack at him, right?"
"Of course," Harbath replied.
"Good," she said as she turned to walk out the door.
"So do I. I'll text you in an hour, and we'll pick a place to meet. In the meantime, have Sal help you find a hotel. If you're lucky, he'll put in the good word with his sister. She's one of the assistant managers at the Four Seasons."
As he watched her leave, Harbath looked at the male detective and realized that he probably had a better chance of having the killer walk right into the police station than he did of having Cordero's partner put in the good word for him anywhere, much less with his sister at the Four Seasons Hotel. Chapter 38. Fort Belvoir, Virginia. After purchasing groceries and a few extra items of clothing, McGee and Ryan returned to Brenda Durkin's. With coffee brewed, they made sandwiches and turned the colonel's dining room into their makeshift operations center. The name of each member of Ryan's former destabilization team was written on a 3x5 card and taped to the wall. Under those, cards were added based on what Ryan could remember about her teammates, including physical descriptions, training and experience levels, where they lived, what their marital status was, if they had children, and what their weaknesses and potential pressure points were, among other things. They were attempting to create the best 30,000-foot picture possible,
and from there they would zoom in on their target. Stevenson, the community bank manager, had been very helpful. The reams of banking information he provided included credit histories, ATM transactions, and credit card statements. Two team members had even set up their mortgages through Stevenson's bank. The guy Ryan ultimately wanted, though, had been much more careful. His personal financial presence in the data was almost non-existent. There was only the corporate stuff. He had been smarter than the rest of the team members and had established follow-on bank accounts for his money to wash through. Even if somebody pierced the community bank, they'd have a lot more work to do to track down where he lived. That was fine by her. They'd catch up with Tom Cushing, the team's leader, eventually. They weren't looking for the head of the pack now anyway. They were looking to pick off someone a little bit further back. As far as Ryan was concerned, they had taken a significant leap forward. The team had not been disbanded. It had just been pushed further into the shadows. The question that she didn't want to wrestle with, but which was still there, was why had she been cut loose? Why did they not bring her along with them? She had thought she had been a pretty good fit, even when she was acting as her teammate's conscience. Was that it? Was that why she had been let go? Had her morality been that inflexible? Granted, she'd been fairly rigid when she joined the team, but once she'd been tossed in the deep end and saw not only how much was at stake, but how ruthless the enemies of the country were, she had begun to quickly play ball. Maybe her being added to the team had only ever been window dressing. Maybe someone on the seventh floor had leaned on Phil Durkin, and he had assigned her to the team in order to appear like he was at least trying to make things right. Who the hell knew what was real and what was fiction when it came to anything anymore at the CIA? Ryan forced the question from her mind. It was a rabbit hole that went absolutely nowhere. There were bigger things she needed to focus on at the moment. The Eclipse team still existed, and they were still being funded via the Central Intelligence Agency. That was a big part of the puzzle that had now fallen into place. The next question she needed answered was what they were up to. Were they destabilizing Islamic countries so that their current governments could be overthrown and replaced? If so, was Jordan on their list? And if it was, how far along were they? And who else beside the Muslim Brotherhood figures that had been photographed meeting with them in Cyprus were they involved with? Nafi would want all the details. Of that, she was sure. She was also sure of what their next move should be, but McGee didn't agree. He liked the idea of isolating one of the team members. He just didn't like the person she had picked. McGee had his own feelings when it came to whom they could double back against Phil Durkin and the team. "There is no way you'll get Tara to crack," Ryan had told him. "The hell I won't," the man replied. "Everyone cracks. Drag their kids in, and they crack so fast, your head'll spin."
"We're not bringing anyone's children into this."
"That's a mistake."
"Jesus, Bob, we're talking about little kids."
"What kind of monster do you think I am?" McGee retorted. "Nothing's going to happen to them. We're just going to use them for leverage." Ryan fixed him with a withering look.
"No, we're not."
"So then what? We go with your guy, Florence of Arabia?"
"Cut it out. Florentino makes more sense than Tara at this point. He's the weakest one on the team. He's the person I had the strongest rapport with. And based on his credit card history, we know what bar he spends every Tuesday night in when he's in town."
"The only reason you two had such strong rapport is because he didn't try to put the make on you."
"He actually had reservations about many of the things Cushing was pushing the team to do."
The older operative stood looking at the names on the wall and took a sip of coffee. "Just because your Arabist had his moral compass set a little truer north than the rest of them," he said, lowering his mug, "doesn't mean he's going to cooperate with us."
"We'll see what happens."
"I'm telling you, it's a mistake. We should go after the Tara woman. We use her kids, she talks, and bang, we're golden."
"No kids, no bang."
"I didn't mean bang as in..."
"I know what you meant, but we're done discussing leveraging anybody's children. I'm not doing that. Understood?"
McGee was silent, and Ryan shot him another look.
"Understood?"
"Fine," he finally replied. "We'll do it your way. No kids."
"And you'll let me handle Florentino?"
You promise to stay out of my way?
What are we, suddenly in a negotiation?
No, she said. This isn't a negotiation. It's an operation. And I want to make sure that there's no confusion as to chain of command. This was my team. I know these people. This is my op. Easy enough?
Fine, McGee relented again. But let's just be clear on one thing.
What's that?
The minute any guns come out, this becomes my op, and we do things my way.
Chapter 39. Washington, District of Columbia. Florentino Marque had been born in Brooklyn, New York, and was the only child of an Italian father and a Puerto Rican mother. He had attended Columbia University, where he showed considerable aptitude for languages, particularly Arabic. From there, he had gone on to Georgetown and a master's degree from the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. The Central Intelligence Agency made their approach shortly thereafter. He was a tall, thin man with dark features and curly hair. With his black-framed eyeglasses and retro fashion sense, he came off as more geek than chic. There were at least 100 other hipster men in the crowded bar dressed just like him. Waitresses shuttled to and fro with pitchers of beer and trays laden with rings and wings. Televisions mounted on every wall broadcast a myriad of current as well as classic sporting events. It was difficult for Ryan to move through the crowd unimpeded. Table after table of young men invited her to join them, some less sober and more insistent than others. Finally, she spotted Florentino. He was sitting with a group of friends in a booth. Instead of talking to each other, they were all looking down at their phones, texting. Occasionally, some team on one of the TVs would score, the crowd would cheer, and Florentino's booth full of hipsters would look up and react. Tipping a waitress to slide him a cocktail napkin with a cryptic message had occurred to her, but Florentino was too smart and too paranoid to bite on something like that. Guys like him didn't get sent notes on cocktail napkins. She was trying to come up with another option when she saw him tuck his phone in his pocket, say something to his friends, and get up from the table. As he walked toward the restrooms, she fell in step behind him and followed. Her question now was whether she was going to present herself before or after he used the men's room. Probably better to wait till after. Slowing her pace, she picked a spot where she could wait and watch for him to come back out. He didn't go into the men's room, though. He kept walking toward the back of the building. He hip-checked the crash bar on a fire exit and stepped outside. Smoke break? She needed him isolated anyway. Behind the building was just as good as any place else. Besides, it was too noisy inside. She could barely hear herself think. Catching the door before it closed, she slipped outside behind him. The rain had recently stopped, and a mixture of young men and women stood in the puddled alley smoking and carrying on conversations. Florentino stood near a dumpster with his back to her. He never was very good at tradecraft. He was more academic than true field operative, and no matter how many times she had tried to impress upon him the need for situational awareness, he had never seemed to get it. It was obvious by the ease with which she was able to approach him that he still didn't.
"Hello, Florentino," she said.
The young man looked over his shoulder and then turned to face her.
"Lydia," he said. "What the hell are you doing here?" "I'm supposed to meet a friend for drinks. I thought she might be back here having a smoke. What are you doing here?"
"Out with friends, too. Drinking, you know."
"Yeah."
"You got your hair cut," he said. "It looks good."
"Cool." "Thanks. So, what have you been up to?"
The young man paused, reluctant to answer. "Not much, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that."
"Florentino, you don't have to lie to me," Ryan replied. "I know what you've been doing."
"What are you talking about? What have I been doing?"
"From what I've been told, lots and lots of travel. How was the food in Cyprus?"
"Cyprus?" he said, stalling. "That's in Greece, right?"
"Or Turkey, it depends."
"Yeah, right. You mind if I," he said, fishing out a pack of smokes from his pocket and holding them up.
"No, go ahead.
You know how bad those things are for you, right?" He smiled, tapped one out, and pulled it from the pack with his mouth. "You sound like my mom."
Your mom's right,
said Ryan, as she watched him remove his lighter and fire up his smoke. His hand appeared to have a slight tremble.
How are you doing? He asked after a deep drag. I heard you're still with the company, huh? How's that been going?
I don't have a lot of time. How about we talk about Cyprus instead?
It sounded like a question, but it wasn't.
Okay,
he replied, his eyes flicking to the left. Ryan glanced over her shoulder.
Are you expecting someone, Florentino?
Me? No. I mean, one of my friends was supposed to come out for a smoke, too.
In the meantime, tell me about Cyprus. Better yet, she said, growing uncomfortable. Why don't we step back inside?
He pulled the cigarette from between his lips and held it up as he exhaled a cloud of smoke.
Can't smoke in there. Well, when we're done talking, you can come back outside.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Ryan was going to ask why that wasn't a good idea when she saw his eyes shift once again. This time, though, there was something different about the way he did it, and the blood in her veins turned to ice. Dropping to the ground, she spun and was just about to pull her Glock when a volley of shots rang through the alley. Chapter 40. Ryan had pulled Florentino to the ground and was trying to maneuver them to cover behind the dumpster. There was chaos as the smokers ran in multiple directions, screaming.
You knew,
she wanted to yell at Florentino, but then she noticed he wasn't moving. He had a gunshot wound to the chest and another at the base of his throat. Blood ran from his mouth as he lay on the wet pavement. As she reached out to feel for a pulse, two more shots skipped off the side of the dumpster, and Ryan leapt back.